serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an amazing journey today with 95-year-old Norris Jernigan of Visalia, California, one of the last remaining veterans of the 393rd Bomb Squadron, famous for the missions of Enola Gay and Boxcar 75 years ago this week. Norris did get a ride in a B-29 during World War II and again decades later, but his job was in the intelligence office on Tinian. He served under Paul Tibbetts, who piloted the Enola Gay on August 6, 1945. And I know you had a chance to interact with him over the years that followed at reunions. One time you even got a flyover by a B-2 bomber flown by his grandson. But the Paul Tibbetts you knew, what do you think we need to know about him? The significance of his decision to fly the plane, the burden that he carried for the rest of his life. And have you ever run into perspectives or opinions that you would say maybe that's a little bit off from the man I knew and the situation I saw firsthand?
Colonel Tibbetts was a real down-to-earth person. When we were together overseas, he didn't demand attention and saluting and all that. You know, he was just, we were all a team. As long as you did your job. If you didn't do your job, he could turn the switch the other way and become your commanding officer and really know how to handle the situation. I didn't have a whole lot of personal contact with him because, after all, he was a colonel and I was a private. But it just doesn't mix back then. But my experience around him was that he was very fair, can be very strict. But if everybody did their job, there was no reason to be tough and strict on people, because it was going to take a team effort to make this thing work. I think he had decided from the very beginning, when it came time to fly that first mission, he would fly it himself, because they had no idea whether that airplane could leave the area in time to not be blown apart with the bomb, even at 30,000 feet. I think he felt strongly that he wasn't going to ask somebody else to do something that he wouldn't do himself. So he elected to fly as airplane commander on that first mission. I can understand why. It was an awesome responsibility that the guy was given. He was called into General Ent's office around September 1st, 1944. He had really distinguished himself over in Europe as a commander of a B-17 group flying bombing missions to Germany. And when it came time to do the test pilot work on the B-29, because the Army Air Corps couldn't take delivery on them yet because there were so many bugs in the thing and so many of them crashing, it was gaining the title of a flying coffin, you know. It was dangerous. So they needed one of their own pilots rather than Boeing's test crews to come back and fly the thing and could recognize the weaknesses because he was an experienced pilot flying bombing missions. They brought him back from Europe to fly the bugs out of the B-29, which he did very successfully. When that was completed, that's when he was called to General Ent's office. Because he had distinguished himself through the whole thing, through his bombing missions of Europe to flying the bugs out of the B-29, nobody knew the B-29 better than Paul Tibbetts did, because it became usable for the Army Air Corps to use because of him being able to fly the thing and detect where the weaknesses were, to have them make the corrections so that the thing could finally come into production and the government could be furnished B-29s to form these B-29 groups. So a lot of credit should go to him for that. Anyhow, he was told what the mission would be and that he was given the task of putting together a military unit that would deliver this bomb to Japan. He was given some sites to use for this group, Wendover being one of them, and Wendover was selected because of the being so isolated out there on the edge of the salt flats that it was ideal for security. And he was also given the code name Silver Plate, which gave him all kinds of priorities to put this thing together, because he had to override a lot of people that outranked him on getting personnel there, like selecting a bomb squadron, for instance. So, you know, he earned the right to be the airplane commander to fly that first mission. But I think the real decision was that he wouldn't ask somebody else to do it if he didn't know whether it was a suicide mission or not.
Wow. Takes a lot of courage, doesn't it?
Yeah. But he had it. He was a military man from the word go. He went to military school before he ever went into the Army Air Corps. An interesting story about how he got into it. He was going to college back in the 1930s. About 1936, he was nearing completion of his college. And his dad had decided, I guess the day he was born, that he was going to become a doctor, so he had to go to medical school. Well, while he was going to college, he got so interested in flying, he went out to the airport near the college and took some flying lessons, and he just loved it. And the more he got into it, the more he knew that that's what he wanted to do rather than become a doctor. Some of the other guys his age were experiencing the same thing, and so they heard about the Army Air Corps cadet program where you could join the Army Air Corps, and they would train you to become a pilot, and you would become a commissioned officer and a full-fledged pilot. So he decided to do the same thing. So he went ahead and applied, and he was accepted. And then it came time to go home for Christmas break. And how do I explain this to Dad? Oh, boy. He knew his dad would hit the ceiling. So when he went home, his mother cornered him one day, and she said, "Son, I know there's something troubling you, and I want to know exactly what's going on with you." So he leveled with her and told her. So she said, "Well, son, if that's where your heart is, go for it." So he became so appreciative of her for helping him to get into flying, which he wanted to do. That's why the airplane that he knew was going to become a famous airplane should be titled Enola Gay. It's after Enola Gay Tibbetts, his mother.
So you miss the takeoff, but then they're gone. How do you hear about what happened and that this gadget has finally been unleashed?
Well, we heard that the bomb had been dropped and it was successful. That's all we knew at that point until the crew got back and landed and then came back and went through the interrogation and then joined our group. It was a holiday all day on August 6th, as we knew that mission was the thing, the big thing. So nobody did any work that day. We just were playing all day, softball and carnival-type things. And when the crew was released from the interrogation, Colonel Tibbetts came out to the area where we were having our picnic. It was right outside the encampment. And got up on the platform, and he said, "Well, successful mission. Sighted city, destroyed same." And then when we could, in the intelligence office, could read the reports of the interrogation and the explanation of what happened, to hear all the explanation about the size of the fireball. And that's exactly what that atomic explosion is. It's just a huge fireball. But anyhow, hearing the reports and seeing the reports, realized what a devastating thing that was. And we thought, that was it. We'll go home now. But the Japanese said, "No, we think we're going to win this. Mm-hmm. We think we can still turn it around and win it." So, okay, the next bomb arrived, which is a different bomb than the first one. The first one was a uranium bomb, and the second one was a plutonium bomb. That mission was scheduled. All the briefings went through, the same as the first one, and come August 9th, they took off about the same time in the morning to fly to Kokura, which was their initial target. The secondary target was Nagasaki. But when they got to Kokura, it was clouded over. They couldn't see the target, and they were told to bomb visually, not by radar. Because of the expense of this project, they couldn't afford to waste the bombs because they didn't have that many of them yet. So Kokura, they could not drop their bomb there. When they flew these missions, they rendezvoused with two other airplanes around Iwo Jima that would escort the bomb-carrying plane to its target. Same thing with Hiroshima. They did not continue with the bomb-carrying plane when the bomb-carrying plane entered the bomb run. They peeled off separately. One of the accompanying airplanes was carrying electronic equipment that they would drop by parachute to measure the effects of the explosion. The other one was carrying photographic equipment to record it. Anyhow, when they tried to rendezvous over Iwo Jima, one of the planes showed up, but the other one, it wasn't there. Didn't make it. So they circled around and circled around and circled around for a long time, waiting for that other plane to show up. Nobody ever did find out exactly what happened. I think they finally determined that the other plane was at a wrong altitude. They were in the same area, but at different altitudes and never linked up. So they went on to Kokura, and because of it clouded over, they saw several bomb runs over the target area, hoping that the clouds would break so they could visually bomb Kokura. It never did. So they elected to fly on. They better fly on because the fuel amount was getting down. So they went on to the secondary target of Nagasaki, dropped the bomb, and at that point they knew they didn't have enough fuel to get back to Tinian. So they elected to Okinawa. They were coming in hoping to land, and they asked permission to land and were denied permission to land. So they decided to throw out their flares, which means they had an emergency aboard. Usually that they have wounded aboard is what they mean when they throw the flares out. Still didn't get any permission to land, so they landed anyhow. And they said once the wheels touched down on the runway, one of the engines started cutting out. That's how close it came to not making it. And so they were able to refuel, then take off and fly back to Tinian. But not too many people were aware of that at the time. It was after the fact that we learned it, why it took them so long to get back to Tinian. But after the second one was dropped, the Japanese reconsidered and on August 14th said, okay, we accept unconditional surrender. We give up. It's unfortunate that they didn't give up before we ever got over there. They were really, there wasn't much left to bomb by the time we got over there. But the fact that one bomb could destroy a whole city was what finally made them decide. Because they were told in the Potsdam Proclamation that their whole country would be destroyed, one city after another. Okay, two of them are gone. Now what's the next one? Mm-hmm. The next one would have been Kokura.
And the news of that Japanese surrender, when that hit your intelligence office on Tinian, what was that like?
Well, it was funny. We were sitting around late at night, probably playing cards or whatever, but pretty close to midnight, and all of a sudden we heard somebody shout outside, "It's over!" We thought, what? So we all, of course, rushed outside to see what it was all about. This guy said he had his radio on, and he just had heard that the Japanese had surrendered. Well, that first go-around was a false alarm. It wasn't so. So I've forgotten what date it was after August 9th that General LeMay put every bomb group's B-29s in the air to make a massive run on dropping bombs on Japan. They didn't know whether it was going to be atomic bombs or not in Japan, and I guess that was the final straw, because I've heard other groups say, no, it wasn't the atomic bombs that ended the war, it was our last bomb run that did it. Well, sure, it contributed, but I don't think it had contributed as much as the two atomic bombs did.
Well, and you've had the better part of 75 years to ponder that, to understand it, to learn more about the other things around you that were happening that you weren't privy to at the time. What's your perspective now? What should we understand about that situation, its significance, what might have happened if those bombs weren't dropped? How do you explain that? Because I'm sure you get asked that quite a bit.
Oh, yes. If those two bombs had not been dropped on November 1st of that year, the invasion of Japan proper was to take place. There were massive troops on Okinawa and the Philippines to make that huge invasion. The Japanese knew it. They moved troops to that area to give us a reception when they arrived. Not only that, we understand they instructed all the Japanese civilians to fight to the death. Never give up. Fight to the death. It'd be to the glory of the emperor to do that. Fight with sticks, stones, pitchforks, whatever you can grasp, but do not surrender. Fight to the death. Okay, our invading forces would have had to fight all those Japanese forces that had been moved into that area. Plus, they'd had to fight the Japanese civilians. So it would have been a bloody, bloody war. Probably the first phase of our invasion would have been suicide missions, because they would have been wiped out. And they would just have to keep pouring troops in, pouring them in to make that a successful invasion. Because the Japanese just weren't ready to give up. I've had so many people through the years say, oh, thank God for what you guys did. My grandfather was on Okinawa with the invading force in training, getting ready for that invasion. Or my grandfather or my uncle or my dad was on Philippines with the invading force. What you guys did stopped that invasion. So they said, thank you for that, or I wouldn't be here. You know, and they're right. So it would have been the bloodiest battle in the world's history, as far as I'm concerned. Oh, I've heard all kinds of speculation about, oh, no, it wouldn't have been that, you know, but just face the facts, for heaven's sakes.
I'm sure you've seen the intelligence estimates at the time, where they said even just the initial invasion, it could have cost 1 million American lives, and many times that in Japanese lives.
That's right. Both sides, yes.
Yeah. So these two bombs claimed an extraordinary number of lives, devastating.
Yes.
But your view is, in the process, they saved millions more lives.
That's right. It's sad that so many people were wiped out with those two bombs. But let's look at Tokyo. You don't hear much criticism about the napalm bombs, which are just a horrible weapon of just literally burning people up with that napalm. You don't hear anything about that, you know. But the two atomic bombs were so inhumane, you know. Should never have done it. We should have dropped one out in the ocean just to demonstrate to the Japanese the force of it. Well, what damage would it have done out there? It probably killed a bunch of fish, but, you know, it had to be done. That was the reason it was developed. That was the reason it was used. And the use of it stopped the war, as far as I'm concerned. I'm glad they were dropped, no question about it. I'm glad they've never been used again. I hope they never will be. We never learn from our wars. We think we do. We think, oh, this is the one that'll end all wars. Well, that's what World War I was for. That's what World War II was for. Well, we've been in war ever since World War II, in one place or another. It hasn't ended the wars. You know, as long as there's people on this earth, there's going to be wars in some form or another until the end of time when Christ comes back. He'll put a stop to the whole thing, and it'll be put set straight again. But as long as there's people, and people choose to hate, and there is so much hate in the world right now, that how can we ever get together and solve any problems? There's only one answer, and that's Christ. He's the answer, and if we would get the whole world to turn to Christ, that would solve all of our problems.
When August 6th comes around on the calendar every year, and this year it's a big one, the 75th anniversary.
Yes.
What do you think about? What crosses your mind on that date each year?
I'm still proud of the fact that I was part of something big. My job was not that big. I was a clerk in the intelligence office. I never touched either of those bombs. Never actually saw one. The one I saw was covered with canvas, so I didn't actually see the bomb. So, you know, just knowing that I was part of something that big that at least stopped war for a little while. That war in the Pacific was so, so cruel and bloody. It was terrible, absolutely terrible for both sides. At that point in my life, I had a great strong hate for the Japanese. But once the war was over, I feel like it's time to set things aside, restore our respect for each other, and let's go on from there and try to make it a better world. And I think in a lot of ways that happened for a while.
That's just a part of your life, a part of your life that I'm sure has influenced a whole lot of your life. But When you look back over 95 years, is there something that you'd say you're most proud of?
Yes, my marriage. I met my wife about 2 weeks after I was discharged from the service, and we just hit it off from the very beginning. And by December of that year, we were married. When she passed away, we'd been married 68 years as of December 29th, 2014. And she passed away then in April 2015, very suddenly. Proud of those 68 years. Just a great life.
And even though you're 95, you don't look 95. You don't sound 95 to people listening on the radio. I don't know if you act 95. Is there something that you're still looking forward to that's still on the list?
If you want to see me act 95, walk into my bedroom before I get up in the morning and see me get out of bed, trying to get my joints back in position. So.
What still motivates you or keeps you going?
Just to keep going. You know, I just have to assume that I'm here, still here, because God has something for me to do. I don't know what it is. May never know. But I think once it's accomplished, if it's ever completely accomplished, then God will say, okay, come on home.
Well, selfishly, I'm thankful that hasn't happened yet, and we've had the opportunity to listen for the last hour. As soon as COVID-19 restrictions are lifted, they're going to be hearing Mr. Jernigan's voice again in the choir at Gateway Church in Visalia, California. And if you want to hear a little more of his story, you can pull up the extended podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.